Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The country didn't know it at the time, but during the summer of 1972, 40 years ago this summer, the nation and its top political leaders were beginning a series of mistakes, of crimes that would become known as the Watergate scandal. And it led to this warning to the President of the United States by his 32-year-old White House counsel.
There's no doubt about the seriousness of the problem we've got. We have a cancer within, close to the presidency, that's growing. It's growing daily. It's compounding. It grows geometrically now because it compounds itself.
That was White House counsel John Dean telling Richard Nixon in March of 1973 that there was a cancer on the presidency. And in August, the president resigned. John Dean would later plead guilty to obstruction of justice and spend 4 months in prison. Now John Dean is trying to teach other lawyers the lessons of Watergate. He teaches a class to lawyers right here in Columbus next week. John Dean, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning.
Let's go back 40 years. What were you doing, say, 40 years ago today? Not necessarily just today, but August of 1972. Were you dealing with Watergate at the time? Was it a worry?
It was very early in the cover-up at this point. The president had just gotten back from San Clemente, and we were still trying to figure out what had happened and why it had happened.
So what had happened with the break-in and what was...
Exactly. What happened is on June 17th, five men were arrested wearing business suits and surgical gloves right outside the office of Democratic National Committee Chairman Larry O'Brien. And we really, it was such a botched job, we didn't know who all was responsible. It didn't take us very long to put together the pieces. It was Gordon Liddy's operation, but we were concerned whether it was actually botched on purpose, whether it was there was a double agent involved. By mid-August, though, we had a pretty good idea of what all had gone.
So you had no clue, you personally, top staff at the White House, had no idea that this break-in was going to happen, that things like this were happening at the time?
I actually happened to have been in Manila, in the Philippines, giving a speech on June 17th, and was planning on, I had gone over quickly for the speech what was then the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and now is the DEA. But I was told by one of my assistants, I better get back. There had been this break-in at the DNC, and it didn't take us very long to put together, as I say, that it was Liddy's operation. But we didn't know who all was involved and who had approved it. And it would take months to find out, in fact, that before John Mitchell, the former attorney general who was running the campaign, would actually concede to myself and to Bob Haldeman that he had approved the operation. It was botched from start to finish. What happened is that the men who had been arrested, two of the men who had been arrested, as well as Hunt and Liddy, who were the sort of the guiding forces behind the whole thing, had been involved when working at the White House in a break-in that I had no knowledge of either, at the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, after he had leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers, a study of the origins of the Vietnam War, which upset Nixon quite a bit, and for good reason. They were all classified secrets, and Kissinger told Nixon that he'd have trouble conducting foreign affairs if something wasn't done effectively with the fact that the United States couldn't hold its secrets. So one of the schemes they cooked up was to try to find out what else Ellsberg was doing by breaking into his psychiatrist's office. They found nothing, but they had left a trail, again, that came right back to the White House. This is what really drove the cover-up from the White House point of view, was this earlier break-in. I didn't know if the president had approved it. I did know that John Ehrlichman, his top domestic advisor, had approved it, as well as a number of members of the White House staff had been involved in it. Chuck Colson had raised the money for it. Bud Krogh, a deputy of John Ehrlichman, had really been immediately the approver of it and one who had suggested it. David Young, who'd worked for Kissinger, had been involved in it. So this came right back to the White House when these men were arrested at the DNC. I think had it just been the botched campaign doing this, they would have been cut loose and it would have never come back to the White House. But because these same men had been used in an earlier foiled operation, that's why the White House was motivated to cover it up.
We're speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel. He is reflecting on Watergate 40 years later. A question for our listeners: how did Watergate change your view of politicians, lawyers? If you're a lawyer, how do you view Watergate? John Dean, of course, was the White House counsel, and there were many lawyers involved in Watergate, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But if you have a question for John Dean, want to weigh in on how Watergate affected how you view public officials and public life, give us a call, 292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter if you'd like to chime in there. So when did it, you mentioned this was very early in the August of 1972. At what point, you say you became the desk officer, trying to coordinate all of the players in the White House and the reelection campaign to contain the damage of this crisis, of this brewing scandal. When did it start to become more and more serious?
Well, when I use the term desk officer, I got that role because there were certain personality conflicts between some of the players. John Ehrlichman, for example, and John Mitchell could barely get along in the same room and often couldn't speak. They could communicate through me. I had worked for John Mitchell at the Department of Justice. I'd been the Associate Deputy Attorney General. And then I'd come over to take Ehrlichman's job when he went up to become head of domestic policy. He had been White House counsel, and so he remained involved in the counsel's office as he moved up. I could communicate between those two key players in this whole thing, both having exposure and liability, not wanting to talk to the other. Mm-hmm. And that sort of made me the linchpin, if you will, for all these schemes and plans of how to deal with it. One of the first things I had suggested was that we needed to get a criminal lawyer in there to help us, because I told Ehrlichman, I said, none of us have background in criminal law. And it was that's probably one of the problems. Had somebody been trained as a criminal lawyer, we would have been looking for the problem areas, the kind of offenses that can happen in a cover-up situation. That couldn't have been further from our mind. It was the middle of a campaign, a reelection campaign for the president, and everybody was thinking of the politics of it rather than the legality of it. And, you know, these patterns repeat themselves. I've been following the Penn State situation, what happened after Sandusky started misbehaving, and they learned of it, and they started covering it up, right up through the lawyers. So these there are recurring lessons that can be learned from these kind of events.
We're speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel, a key figure in the Watergate scandal, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon. Now he is teaching a class, trying to share his lessons with others, particularly with lawyers, and how they should handle themselves when faced with difficult ethical decisions. How did it go from these early days to your famous conversation with the president where you said this was a cancer on the presidency?
Well, initially, the White House counsel, both when I was there and even to this day, remains something of a middle-level staff position, where if the president calls on you, you're right there, but you don't really have daily access unless there's some sort of a crisis or some Supreme Court opinion has come down that the president wants some insight into or something of that nature. So I wasn't dealing with the president initially. In fact, I'm doing a project right now, Mike, that's kind of interesting. Viking, my publisher, convinced me to go back and look at Watergate. And I said, well, I'll do that. And I assumed all the Watergate tapes had been transcribed, at least those that were important. And indeed, about 400 transcripts exist out there, about 80 by the Watergate prosecutor's office. And then a historian by the name of Stanley Cutler, who expedited the release of the tapes did about 400. I said, well, I mean, about 320, and that's about 400 conversations. I figured, well, that's all the good stuff and the important stuff. That was a wrong assumption. I found another 1,600 conversations that Nixon had on Watergate.
Wow.
So I'm in the process. I've had transcribers working on this for about a year and a half now, shooting to get my book done by the 40th anniversary of Nixon's departure and really understand what happened. One of the interesting things is how little Nixon was told about what was really going on in the early days. When I start dealing with him about 6 months in February of 73, I mince no words. And at one point I'm say to myself, he doesn't really understand everything I know, and you just don't go in and be too blunt with the leader of the Western world or any client for that matter. So I sort of at one point realized I had to lay this out because he was asking me to write a bogus report that would make it all go away, and it wasn't going to all go away with a bogus report. Only the truth was going to deal with it, and that was the so-called cancer on the presidency conversation, and that's really the centerpiece of our current class. We're actually back in Ohio with this continuing legal education program by popular demand. Mm-hmm. We did it about a year ago. Where we just looked at the first week with all the mistakes that were made in the very early stage. And it was so popular that the Ohio State Bar asked us to come back and repeat the program for another phase of it because there's so many mistakes made. There's a lot of lessons that can be learned from this. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is take the historical events and apply today's modern rules of professional conduct, which really emanated directly out of Watergate, to that situation. Not only does it give lawyers who practice today some interesting insights into history, but it gives them information they can use in their day-to-day practice.
We're speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon, a key figure in the Watergate scandal, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Did you know those you were being recorded when you were speaking to the president?
Well, that's one of the reasons that it actually surfaced that there were recordings. One conversation on April 15th of 1973, Nixon's behavior was so unusual that I suspected I had been recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And then he makes a statement to one of the head of the criminal division that, well, he's got a recording of something, and just in a sort of a by the way, and it just clicks with me. And I tell the government and I tell the Senate Watergate Committee when I testify, I think I was taped, and Nixon seems to have conceded it. So I think you ought to get those tapes.
When you made your cancer on the presidency, when you had your conversation that included that, did you know then or suspect then you were being taped? No.
No, it was later. That was on March 21st, the cancer on the presidency. It's on April 15th. He asked me a bunch of leading questions, which was unusual. Then he literally gets up and goes to the corner of the office and speaks to me in a stage whisper. And at that moment, I said, you know, he's recording these calls. He doesn't want what he's saying on the recording.
Uh-huh. Interesting. What were the conversations like? What was the feeling in the room when you were discussing the break-in and the earlier, when you learned of the earlier break-in and how to handle it and how to contain the damage? You said that folks didn't get along, but... what were those conversations like? Was there any realization?
That's one of the lovely things of first of all, modern technology. We've been able to go back and take what were analog recordings that were pretty crude and clean them up and digitize them. And we use a lot of them during the program. We did during our so-called Watergate 1 seminar. Now we even have more because they were... the audience and the lawyers, incidentally, not only lawyers come, but we've done about 45 of these programs now.
Mm-hmm.
We find that the lawyers often bring their clients, they bring their spouse, because it has a lesson for lawyers, it's just apparently good theater and good history for others. So we play the tapes, and people can get, you can't read a transcript and get the same feel for the conversation, anything close to what when you hear it.
But the tension in the room, in the body language and things like that, that's hard to see on the – can you hear that on the tape?
You can hear that on the tape.
Yeah.
No question. It's curious that I happened to – not knowing there was a taping system, and the microphones in, say, the Oval Office were all drilled and plugged right into the wooden desk. And I seem to, every time I go in, to sit right over a microphone, and my voice was very easily picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon's it would slide back. It's clear sometimes in some of the conversations, he knows he's being recorded and is intentionally saying things to put on the record. But that's seldom.
Yep.
It's a voice-activated system that comes on when he's speaking in that room. And so he forgets most of the time, as do the only people who knew about the system were Bob Haldeman and two of his deputies, Alex Butterfield and Larry Higby, who'd had the system installed, and then the Secret Service that maintained the system. And that was a very few people in the Secret Service who were privy to it also.
We're speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon. We're talking about the lessons of Watergate. We'll continue our conversation and take your calls when we return here on 89.7 NPR News.
Harry Reid demands Mitt Romney's tax returns, but he won't release his own. The campaigns trade jabs on welfare reform and tax plans. And in Missouri, Claire McCaskill's re-election campaign is in real trouble. I'm Tom Gelton. Political junkie Ken Rudin is back. Plus, where we get our facts. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And when you support our station at $85, you'll receive the WOSU member card. The member card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 member card partners in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/member card for more information. 85 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine warming up to 95 today. There is a slight chance of a shower this afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 67. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about Watergate 40 years later. What lessons can we learn from the scandal after four decades? Our guest is John Dean, one of the key figures in the Watergate scandal. He was White House counsel for Richard Nixon. Let's go to the phones. Mark, you're on the air with John Dean here on 89.7 NPR News.
Yes, I would just like to thank Mr. Dean from the bottom of my heart for telling the truth. I think that if Nixon got away with what he did, we might as well not have a president. We'd have a dictator. So I think he rescued the country from tyranny.
You can ask any question you want.
Is that it, Mark? Do you have any questions?
I just have a couple of favorite Nixon quotes. One of them is, "Perjury is a hard rap to prove."
That was in the March 21st conversation.
Mm-hmm. And also, "Blow the safe."
John
okay,
Dean,
come visit with us. We're there on next about a week from today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate what you did. It couldn't be more important. It really couldn't.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
The second quote, John, "Blow the safe." What does that refer to?
That was long before Watergate. After the leak of the Pentagon Papers, Chuck Colson told the president that the Brookings Institute, the think tank in Washington, had a copy of them. And he can be literally heard pounding on his desk, demanding that somebody get in there and blow the safe. What happened? I was unaware the president had ordered this, and I got wind of the fact that they were planning to no less than firebomb the Brookings and then break in when the police or when the fire department responded. I said, this is insane. So the president and his senior aides were in California. I got on a plane, flew to California, to told them that this was, I'd pulled the DC code down and had found that arson that results in a death is a capital offense in the District of Columbia. And I just argued. I said, this is just insanity. And finally, Ehrlichman picked up the phone and called Colson and said, young counsel Dean is out here, Chuck. Doesn't think so much of the Brookings plan. Turn it off. And I flew back to Washington. And so I unaware that Nixon had ordered this. In fact, during the March 21st conversation, I make a reference to the fact that this crazy scheme, and the president doesn't confess that he was behind it.
Interesting. John Dean is our guest here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Watergate and the lessons we can learn from them. Let's take another call. And John, you're on the air.
Okay, John Dean, I can't believe I'm speaking with you. It's a great honor.
Thank you.
Sir, my question for you is, in my lifespan, I was a teenager during Watergate, and then there was Reagan with Iran, Contra,
right.
Clinton with Monica Gate, and then George Bush with Iraq. What was it that Nixon lacked that the other presidents were able to succeed at in surviving?
Well, it was close for Clinton, as we all know. And what happened is Watergate, if you could really make one mistake after another mistake after another mistake, it was done. In fact, that's one of the things I'm looking at in this book I'm doing, is how in the hell could somebody as savvy as Richard Nixon, as politically astute as he is, he was an attorney, how could he make the mistakes he made just one after another? I don't know the answers to those questions. And nobody has ever tracked every single conversation Nixon had to follow the thread of his thinking and his behavior, who's telling him what, and so on. And that's what I'm doing. My own curiosity suggested this book in talking with my publisher. Once they said, let's please return to this subject. We think it's 40 years later. In fact, that's one of the reasons I'm doing this continuing legal education program for lawyers, is my head is back there. And you've just nailed one of the questions I'm trying to answer, is what did he know, when did he know, and what did he do with it? Because it's almost inexplicable that he could have gotten himself in the mess he got himself into.
John Dean is our guest, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon. Do you think subsequent administrations, we talk about lessons learned from Watergate, do you think they saw what happened to the Nixon administration? And then when trouble did crop up, whether it be Iran-Contra or the Monica Lewinsky situation, they saw what you all did and said, okay, we're going to do it differently. Do you think that?
No question, Mike, that happened. I know most of the White House counsel who have followed me, and they really learned from the mistakes we made. Another thing is the fact that of all the post-Watergate reforms, some of the strongest and some of the most lasting have been those in the legal profession. Lawyers involved in Watergate, with the exception of Liddy and Nixon, particularly Liddy, were not just hell-bent on committing crimes. They got across the line by mistakes. This is really the core of our teachings in our seminar. Lawyers who, you know, are hell-bent on crime, they're going to just commit crimes. We have nothing really we can add for that. We just hope they get caught. It's the lawyer who mistakenly crosses the line for lots of reasons, because their antenna isn't up, because they're not following the rules that now are in place. That's the crowd we're trying to help. They don't mistakenly get across the line, and there are lots of lessons from Watergate on that. But you're absolutely right that subsequent White Houses, as well as particularly White House counsel, learned well from the mistakes we made, and hopefully that lesson will be lasting.
Did they also learn how to manage a crisis like this? Because it's always Watergate led to the cliche that it's not the misdeed, it's the cover-up that it was worse.
Well, you know something, that's true and not true in Watergate. I recently, the Washington Post, on the occasion of June 17th, to note the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, couple days before, they had something of a reunion back at the Watergate. I'd never been in the Watergate office complex. And the building is now under renovation from a new owner, and the Post leased the 11th floor of the building and invited about 450 to 500 of the Washington cognoscenti to a program with Ben Bradley and Woodward and Bernstein. Fred Thompson was there, Richard Benvenista, one of the special prosecutors, yours truly, Bud Krogh, another White House aide. In other words, all those who'd been involved in the unraveling of Watergate, they were there, and we had a couple panels and what have you. The fact that what was your question, Mike? I lost.
Well, have administrations learned to when there is a brewing scandal to get out front and don't try to cover it up? I guess that's the question, lesson that could have been learned
from
this.
And I say yes and no. What happens with Watergate? And this is the point I was going to make. At that session, that 40th anniversary, you're looking at Watergate 40 years later by the Washington Post. Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward wrote a piece that. That the underlying crimes of the Nixon administration were probably more serious than the cover-up. Ben Bradley has said that he thought the Iran-Contra situation was worse than Watergate because there was such a deliberate effort to deceive the Congress, who had prohibited the actions they were taking in both Nicaragua and with Iran. So I'm not sure that that's a universal rule that the cover-up is worse than the underlying crime, but it certainly can compound the problem. You take something like Enron. I'm not sure that the cover-up there was worse. I'm not sure that with Penn State, the cover-up is worse than Sandusky's activity. So I don't think that is a universal rule.
It's what... Oftentimes, and especially in federal prosecutions, it can be the thing that puts the person in prison. You don't get convicted of insider trading. You get convicted of lying to a grand jury, and you end up doing time for the obstruction of justice rather than the actual.
As Martha Stewart will tell you.
Yes, that's what I was referring to. We're speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon. He is touring the country, teaching lawyers the lessons of Watergate, and teaching. And as we look back on the 40th anniversary of the start of that scandal. Mark Felt, the high-ranking member of the Justice Department, was revealed as Deep Throat some years ago. Who did you think was Deep Throat?
Well, I dismissed Felt for the simple reason that Bob had once told me that, and I believe I like Woodward. I didn't know him until after Watergate. I never talked to anyone in the press when I was at the White House. But Bob always said, John, every clue in that book is good. That all makes sense when you learn, if you ever learn, who it was. Well, Felt leaves the FBI in May of 73. The biggest, one of the most important clues that Woodward and Bernstein get is in November, the first week of November of 73, when they learn that one or more of Nixon's tapes have been erased. Felt was really in no position. I still have, Bob is not yet to explain how Felt could have known that information. So he really, for that reason alone, was not. But yet, it's interesting, and the tapes show this. We knew Felt was a leak. One of the reasons Felt never really got the job he wanted, which was to be director of the FBI, was because he was a leak. There's a conversation on the 19th of October of 72 where I've been told by the head of the criminal division, Henry Peterson, that a lawyer for Time magazine has come in and told them that Felt is leaking like a sieve. And I think they're doing it to cover themselves for fear of contempt of court for leaking grand jury information or some other crime they might be involved in. And Peterson, a former FBI guy who knew Felt well and didn't think well of him. He called him the white rat because he had premature white hair and was something known as a leaker. He told me this, and I take it back to the White House. Haldeman discusses it with the president, and there's a conversation about it. And it later gets further confirmed by Mitchell, who talks to this lawyer from Time magazine, that Felt indeed is a a source of a serious leak. There was no deep throat at that point, because that happens when Woodward and Bernstein write their book.
Yeah.
But yet we knew that Felt was a leaker, and it's interesting. The existing tapes that are out there, this is one of the things that I've learned from the tapes, the transcripts that are out there, that transcript is out there, but I hear things on these transcripts others don't seem to hear. I even hear it from my transcribers differently. Mm-hmm. And then when I point out what they're actually saying, they say, you're right, that's what he said. It's very hard to hear them, because I say the system is pretty crude. But with Felt, at one point in that conversation where Nixon is learning about Felt being a leak, he says to Haldeman, you know what I would do with Felt? And then he just sort of the Cutler transcripts have him just sort of trailing off and saying, bastard. Mm-hmm. Which is not an unusual word for Nixon to use, but what I hear is something very different. What he says, you know what I would do with Felt, Bob? Ambassadorship.
Oh, okay.
It's huge difference. Yeah. This is what they'll later do with Dick Helms, the head of the CIA, is give him an ambassadorship, keep him happy, and he'll just disappear and be out of their hair. But that wasn't done with Felt.
Speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon, talking about the Watergate scandal all these years later. You were young. You were 30 when you became White House counsel, correct?
Right.
What was it like for someone still early in their career to be the lawyer for the President of the United States?
Great job. Even with Watergate and all the negative things that happened, it was still proved a great experience. It was I was fortunate to have a lot of rather big jobs before I even got to the White House. Mm-hmm. I was the chief minority counsel of the House Judiciary Committee at one point. I was the associate deputy attorney general and then became White House counsel. That kind of experience, you can only get at you can really see government at a different level and its operation from the top. From the bottom, you see how the bureaucracy works, which I had a chance to do, but I was then able to get on the high-level jobs I had. And I pretty well, while the processes have different politics about them, they stay pretty basically the same. And so it gives you an understanding of the way the machinery works that is invaluable. I had never really planned to spend a lifetime in government and ended up pretty much doing what I planned to do, which was investment banking, and did that for about 20 years before I retired, and now started writing out books again.
Did your youth affect, how you handled this scandal? Did it lead to some of the mistakes you made?
Unquestionably. I probably wouldn't, I certainly wouldn't at 60 give Nixon the deference I gave him at 30. I would have been pounding on the table when I went in to tell him the cancer on there was a cancer on his presidency, rather than the reverse. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have taken no for an answer. I certainly learned about the criminal law the way you shouldn't learn about it by getting into the process. Every White House counsel since I was there has either had the experience or had hired somebody on their staff who has experience with the criminal law. It's sad but true. It's essential that the White House counsel have that experience. It never occurred to me that White House counsel needed to be a criminal lawyer when I took the job. With the Nixon administration, I realized it was absolutely vital that the White House counsel be an experienced criminal lawyer. And Nixon doesn't really hire a true and highly competent criminal lawyer until he resigns, when he hires Jack Miller, who had been the former head of the criminal division of the Department of Justice. Fred, I've talked to the Watergate prosecutors. I said, did Fred Buzhardt, who followed me, and Len Garment, who followed me, and St. Clair, who he hired as his special counsel during the impeachment proceeding, I said, did they really know what they were doing? And the guys, all of them said no.
Wow.
St. Clair had some experience, but it was primarily with state law. And so they were dealing with rookies from the Watergate prosecutor's office, and were somewhat stunned that Nixon didn't hire a really competent counsel.
We're speaking with John Dean, former White House counsel with Richard Nixon. We're talking about Watergate and the lessons we can learn from Watergate. We'll talk more about some of those lessons when we continue here on All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News.
Next Fresh Air, an in-studio concert and conversation with singer Susie Arioli and guitarist Jordan Officer. Their new album is called All the Way. Join us. In view.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to join us on WOSU-TV. It is the greatest mass extinction since the dinosaurs. Species by species, amphibians are vanishing. Watch as scientists work to save those that they can. Nature presents Frogs, The Thin Green Line. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Westminster Thurber Retirement Community, hosting an information meeting for its new active adult residents in downtown Columbus. Gooddale Landing, August 14th at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. More information at 228-8888.
86 degrees in downtown Columbus, warming up to a high of 95 today. There is a slight chance of a pop-up shower this afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight with still a slight chance of rain, a low of 67 degrees. Cloudy skies for Thursday, a better chance of showers and thunderstorms, and a high of 84. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're speaking about Watergate 40 years later. What happened? What lessons can we learn from what happened and what happened to the players who were involved? One of the players involved was John Dean, the former White House counsel for Richard Nixon. He is our guest here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. John Dean, one of the things you say is you forgot who your client was. You thought Richard Nixon was your client, but you, as the White House counsel, your client is the office of the President of the United States. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, that's a result of the new rules of ethics that emerged from Watergate. They make it very clear that's one of the first questions that a lawyer must ask, and it's come up in the context of government service as well as for corporations and partnerships, whoever. It's the entity that you represent, not the, say, the president of the corporation or, in this case, the president of the United States. They would typically hire lawyers for their own personal matter that is outside of the entity. And this makes a huge difference in the way you handle it. And this is by following the model rules, which most states like Ohio have adopted. I teach this seminar with a lawyer from Thompson Hine, which is a Ohio-based, Cleveland-based firm. It's a multi-state firm. He's a friend. He's a very able trial lawyer, handles complex litigation. His name is Jim Robinault. Lots of Robinaults in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Their family's been there a long time. Anyway, he didn't really know this rule as well as important as it is and as essential as it is, as we've gone around the country and looked at the various rules that we teach, we find that while the lawyers have passing knowledge of them, they don't really understand how they operate. Watergate has proven itself a wonderful example of how you deal with an entity when you represent the entity versus the people who are the constituents or the officers or employees of the entity.
Is it trickier for a political appointee, a counsel for a government agency, because, you know, the president is picking a person based on many times because of their politics?
Not really. I think they all have their unique twists, but the principles stay the same, and the way to deal with them stay the same. It took us a long time to figure out how to put together our first program and where we landed on the first week. It's taken us months, and we're just in the final stages of it now. I'm actually coming back to Cleveland on Thursday for Jim and I to run through some dry runs before we do the five-city tour of Ohio to sort of hone and stomp and make sure we've got it within the time ranges, because you could literally do this all day. We do it in 4 hours.
Yeah.
And we cover an awful lot of information. We've got a lot of audio-visual material we use. We use the tapes. So we condense an awful lot to share these lessons, to try to make it as engaging and entertaining as it is informative. And so it takes a lot of work.
But if you're an attorney and you have a lot of admiration for your client, whether it be the president of the United States or the CEO of a company, you can lose. You can see how it could be very easy to lose your way based on your admiration for that person, for your agreement with his or her policies and what that person is trying to do. And that's the balance that an attorney needs to make, correct?
Well, that's exactly right. We've seen it in the Penn State situation, where the general counsel there, a very able woman who had been a longtime law professor, she'd been a longtime trial judge, she'd been on the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, and she ends up playing to the president of Penn State rather than the entity that she was really representing. And I don't mean to isolate and pick her out. When you read the report that Judge Free did on that on what went wrong and what had happened, you can see that if she'd gone to our seminar, we could have saved her a lot of grief.
Well, yeah, you have deference to the president of Penn State. Then you have the legendary figure Joe Paterno, which you have to stand up to them as well to represent.
Exactly.
Forgetting who your client is. John Dean is our guest here. A few minutes left here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about Watergate and the lessons that John Dean is trying to teach the lawyers of today. John, I'll admit, I'm in my mid-40s, so I'm not a young guy, mid-career guy. But my recollections of Watergate were the fact that the hearings preempted reruns of Leave It to Bieber on weekday mornings. For folks my age, we've read about it, we've seen the movie, we read the book, but we didn't live through it. How do you teach the lessons to folks who are younger, who didn't live through Watergate?
In fact, that's a part of the audience we're really trying to reach. We're working on how to get ourselves, get this program. Both Jim and I are busy with other things. We have no real sales or marketing. It's all been word of mouth that's resulted in our doing this. We're trying to get into law schools to get to that audience that has... I've been over at USC for over a decade as a visiting scholar, and the kids that come in there don't have a clue who I am. They call generally a week before I come in, they've announced I'm coming, and they call their parents and find out exactly who I am, so I get nice turnout.
Yeah.
But you're right on the cusp today. Jim himself was in his teens, which has helped actually in assembling the program. And what we do is we give enough background and information that anybody can quickly pick up exactly the gist of what happened. So we take people back to that history and give them the information they need to understand what was happening, and then we can draw the lessons from it. It's a refreshing of recollections for those who have some knowledge. And it's an insight into what actually happened for those who didn't. And so it worked pretty nicely.
Okay, let's get to the phones. John, you're on the air. You have a question for John Dean.
Yeah, first, a very quick. John, I've enjoyed your career. I've enjoyed one of your books, and I have this other little volume called Washington Wives by, I'm sure, a distant relative of yours. That's another fascinating little volume, an insight to Washington. Nevertheless, my real point is you're teaching at the end of academic lives for people who are about to go into the businesses they're going to go into, and yet wouldn't it be better if we had courses in ethics and courses in good judgment, because intelligence does not equal good judgment in elementary school, and teach kids the way that we would hope they would behave, because everybody's trying to game the system, both in the 70s, 80s, 90s, now, unfortunately, and, of course, thousands of years ago.
I agree that the earlier this can happen, the better. But I must say, certainly by the time you get through law school, if not through college, you know the difference between right and wrong. And while somebody somebody who wants to break in the Brookings and bomb it, that doesn't take a law degree to know that was wrong. But crimes like conspiracy or obstruction of justice, they're not bright line crimes, and so we try to. We think the rules of professional conduct help highlight, you know, to better understand what you don't know and when you should know it. We've also discovered. I recently spoke up in Boston at a national conference of the ABA on their professionalism and ethics section of the bar. And there was a fellow on that panel with me where I was sort of the fact witness by the name of Richard Painter, who was ethics counsel for George Bush's White House. He's done a lot of work on a fascinating area that I find highly revelatory on the psychology of cover-up, how people get into what's called a loss frame by social scientists, where you're in a no-win situation. And in those situations, you tend to make, and it's been just shown through study after study, really bad decisions. A gambler who's losing is going to double down often and bet worse, and casinos know this. Well, if you look at the history of cover-ups, you look at Penn State, you look at Enron, you look at Iran-Contra, and you look at Watergate.
Yeah, Watergate, you said it was started with the
it happens in spades. You make bad, irrational decisions. So we're incorporating this into our lesson. I happen to write I write for an outfit called Justy, and I just cranked out a column yesterday for this Friday on Penn State about how this psychology of cover-up comes into play and how you can deal with it. There is a very, very easy way to do it, and that is you must bring in outsiders who are not in the loss frame and get their advice and counsel. And the lawyer can do this without violating any privilege by either bringing in outside counsel, going up and talking to your partner, somebody who's not involved in the case. There are ways to do this, and procedures like the rules of ethics come to play. So we've made this something of a core lesson in this new program where we provide the material and additional reading and as well as explain it in more detail I can do in these sound bites, how this really works. And my editor, when I wrote this overview of it for this column, she sent me a note last night. She said, you know, I've been thinking about your column. And she said, boy, this really needs to be taught in law schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. It's universally true, and not only true for lawyers, but just true for businessmen who we find are also drifting into our lawyers, into our seminars.
The lesson, I mean, anything. Like you mentioned the gambling metaphor. It's like if, you know, you get deep in debt, and you cheat a little bit, then you get deeper in debt, and you cheat a little bit more, and that's how a lot of...
You make irrational and bad decisions.
Yeah. Just a few minutes left here with John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon, key figure in the Watergate scandal, and now teaching lawyers the lessons of Watergate. Let's go to David. David, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Mr. Dean, for doing this. I think it's important. Also, there's a current attitude of money is right. No matter how much money you have, it doesn't matter. And that's completely perverting the system. And
you mean campaign money?
Yeah, it's following the Citizens United strategy that we can buy elections. So I don't know how that figures into what you're thinking, but I think it's hurting the whole system. What do you feel?
I think Citizens United is a disaster. It goes back to Buckley versus Viejo, the whole thing of declaring that speech is our money spent in the campaign is a form of speech, and it has to be regulated accordingly. Now Citizens United and its progeny have so distorted that we're in a very dangerous time. And this election is going to be very fascinating for that regard. Hopefully people will be sufficiently appalled that they'll demand that the government take some action. You have... nine justices who could not be more out of touch with the way it works out there in the real political world. I hope they're horrified at the mess they've created for this election. I also can tell you that political advisors are making themselves multiple millionaires. They get the bundlers and the ad placers. They've never made this kind of money before. Karl Rove is going to be a multimillionaire as a result of Citizens United. Mm-hmm. So they're going to do everything they can to keep it out there.
Do you?
But, you know, if we get distorted results where people have clearly bought their seats, money's always been a problem, but we're going to have it regulated in some way.
It has been 40 years since Watergate, and we are in a hyper-partisan time. There is a lot of money being spent on campaigns, more and more every cycle. I'm speaking more about this hyper-partisan feeling that there's no compromise and we're right and the other guys are wrong. Does that fuel for another possible Watergate-type scandal?
Very easily, very easily. I did a book about that I entitled "Conservatives Without Conscience," about authoritarian personalities. By their very own definition, they tend to be on the right side of the political spectrum, and they won't brook listening to compromise and what have you. This is a personality that does not work well in a democracy. And at some point, if it gets sufficiently screwed up, I think those people will realize for their own good that they've got to get out of the system and go find work as anything from the military to police to prison guards, something that will occupy their authoritarian instincts better than the political arena.
Is that feeling more now, do you think, than it was in the late 60s, early 70s?
It certainly starts with Nixon, mm-hmm. who's that kind of attitude, and you know, with the Southern strategy he developed, and he really with Pat Buchanan developed wedge issues that would indeed drive people apart. And it has succeeded beyond wildest dreams. But the sake of winning power for the sake of winning power can only play out so long until it isn't worth winning power. In fact, I know people who are staying out of politics today who otherwise would have come into the system who just don't want any part of it. I mean, who needs it? And this is going to be to the detriment of the country.
We're seeing folks leave
Absolutely. In Ohio are seeing some of the more moderate but still highly conservative. You know, I've always long considered myself a Goldwater conservative. Today that makes me a pretty far left liberal on the spectrum.
Well, John Dean, we could spend hours talking about the Watergate and what happened and the lessons we can learn from it. You'll be in Ohio all of next week in various cities, Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and here in Columbus, trying to teach lawyers the lessons that you learned, the role of a lawyer when it comes to dealing with clients and with dealing with the law. And we appreciate your time.
My time has been a pleasure for me, and just get some good weather for me when I'm back there. It was really nice last year, and I hope it is this year.
Well, it's been hot, but it's been sunny, so we'll take that.
That's good.
John Dean, former White House counsel for Richard Nixon, thanks for joining us here All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. We are streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News is a service of WOSU Public Media. For the All Sides crew, I'm Mike Thompson.